Chairperson, CEO, a rejoinder. Thank you. Can I, Honourable Chair, maybe for the sake of flow, can I maybe start with a question of the CEO, if you don't mind?
You can, but you may.
Thank you very much. Because that's quite a critical question. Indeed, in terms of the CIDP. And thanks, Madam, for asking the question. We, as the CIDP, and particularly as the board, and the subcommittee of the board that was tasked to, interview and finally hire a CEO, I think the subcommittee of the board did that. It really did a good job. We do have very good people on that board. We've done that. We interviewed, we've gone through the process, and where we are in consultation with the minister. The Act demands that before we go ahead with anything, we have to consult with the minister, and that's where we are right now. So in terms of timeline, Honorable Chair, I'm not a politician, so I'm not going to give a political answer. I would safely say that by December, January, we should be settled on that matter. So in other words, by next year, we would have a permanent CEO. In actual fact, all the other acting positions would then reverse. And we're looking forward to a situation where we have that kind of a situation. We are going to make an appointment at that time, an appointment that we think would help us take this organization further. Thank you.
As you have said, sir, you are not a politician, but you have given a political answer.
As a politician, I advise him to say as soon as possible. I'm not saying December or January, but he's not a politician.
Shall we proceed?
Yeah, I think as we proceed, we went into consultation with the acting CEO, and I think we've broken down questions, and there are certain board members who take certain questions, and the acting CEO, obviously, because it's more operational, she will take the bulk of the questions. So maybe let me start with those questions that the board members were assigned to answer, and I'm sorry to confuse the process, but we'll definitely answer all the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. So I've been asked to deal with the question that relates to slide number 19, which speaks to the inadequate access to credit. One of the things that the board has been undertaking for the past 4 months or so is to look at the white paper and to align the white paper to the Act. So one of the proposals was to make amendments to our current Act. And in doing that, we realized that access to finance for our contractors needs to be facilitated. Now, when we say facilitation, what we mean is in terms of creating strategic partnerships with other institutions of finance, because what we need to be careful of is that we're not usurping or we're not reinventing the wheel and taking over responsibilities, for example, that would lie with the IDC. So when we talk about facilitation, for example, is that we would then create these strategic partnerships and then introduce our contractors to certain institutions that can provide access to finance. And not only just access to finance, but as you would know, in the construction industry, contractors are often asked to produce guarantees, where they also have to pay premiums on those guarantees. So one of the amendments that we are looking at currently in terms of introducing into the Act, like I said, is that facilitation and not becoming a credit institution, because that isn't the mandate of the CIDB.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to talk briefly about the issue of the crown payment. The regulations were almost done when we sent them to the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor to be scrutinized. And as is the process in government, when you deal with some of these regulatory processes, it was discovered that the prompt payment regulations that we wanted to implement were not aligned to Section 33 of the CIDB Act. And therefore, the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor deemed the regulation unconstitutional. We are dealing with that matter now through the review of the CIDB Act, because it was felt that we're giving the Minister of Public Works, through the regulation, powers that were not accorded to in the CIDB Act of 2000. But that's where the matter is for now. The nice thing about the regulations that we propose, they're also going to take care of not just prompt payment, but also the inherent issue of conflict within the sector. Between the contractors and subcontractors and all of that. But the process is under the management of Public Works, which is leading the review of the Act. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much. The acting CEO asked me to talk to the issue of the return on investment Mr. Honorable Fultan. I think this is a very important question. It is a critical question. One of the things that we did this year was to go into the provinces, which we did, to begin to listen, and in a sense to measure the impact of the CIDB in all these provinces, as we reported. And I think, Honorable Feltana, you were with us in the Eastern Cape. And just without even getting into figures and being very scientific about it, it's very clear that the return on investment is quite minimal. We are not where we ought to be. So that is one of the things that we picked up very clearly. If we look at the grading system, the impact of those that we are encouraging to get into the industry, the women and the youth, I think the figures speak for themselves. Now, you are right to say that it is one of the issues that we need to focus on, and we're definitely going to do that and come up with measurable ways of checking that exactly. Because if we are saying that we are regulators of this industry, indeed we need to play a central role in the industry, not only regulating the public sector, but also in the private sector as well. But if you look at the capacity currently, we can hardly regulate in the private sector, in the public sector. You know, we have influence, but we don't particularly have the law behind us that says to the municipalities, we will force you to comply to X, Y, Z. So which is part of what we're busy reviewing in terms of the Act. And definitely, in business, if you put in 145 million rand, you need to see the return. So, which is part of definitely next year. That's what we're going to do. And all the strategies that the board has come up with, we are hoping that we're going to begin to see a very revived industry once we start to implement it. Thank you.
Thank you. So the next question I'll be dealing with is in terms of slide 9, where we talk about strengthening and enforcing regulations. The member wanted to know, or for us to elaborate on what we mean by substantive registration requirements for grade 1. Now, currently, grade 1s, when one wants to register with the CIDB for grade 1, one just simply needs to provide their tax clearance certificate, and they are then able, their tax clearance and BEE certificate, and just in terms of compliance, they're then able to register as a grade 1 in the different categories. So we conducted, the board rather conducted a study on the grade 1s earlier this year, and we realized that a lot of the contractors on our system didn't have any knowledge or experience in terms of what is happening in the construction industry. So it was almost like, you know, people were trying to become grade ones simply just to, for lack of a better word, to try to see how they can enter this industry. And being one of our mandates is also to ensure that we are protecting the public. So if we're simply just going to allow grade ones to just register based simply on tax clearance certificates or BEE certificates, we would be remiss in our duty of protecting the public. So one of the amendments that the CIDB is working on, and also which is fed by, like I said, the study that we conducted this year, is to introduce at least some track record or a minimum of skills in the construction industry to say, yes, indeed, you know what the construction industry is about, and yes, indeed, you can then undertake work in the construction industry. And that's really what we mean by saying we want to strengthen the registration requirements for grade 1. Thank you.
Thank you,
ma'am. Honorable Chairperson, thank you. I just get particularly excited about such opportunity. This is the only opportunity I get to delegate upwards. Thanks, Chairperson.
Use it to the full.
Chairperson, I'll deal firstly with the questions that were asked by Honourable Kwala Barnard. Firstly, the issues around the plans with underperformance of processing grade 2 to 9 applications. Yes, we have identified that we have failed to keep up to what we had planned, and that is making sure that we at least achieve 93% of the processing of those grades within the 21-day turnaround time. That said, I just need to mention the fact that, yes, we've identified that as a problem, and what we are currently dealing with is looking at the business process re-engineering. So what the board has said in terms of our strategic discussions and planning sessions is what we are looking at is actually reducing even the 21-day turnaround time, because we're saying it is actually unacceptable with all the systems and the technology that is now available in the world and in the country that we still take almost a month to process and upgrade, and that is in terms of grades 2 to 9. And yes, it is also even more unacceptable the fact that we don't even make the 21-day turnaround time in certain instances. So we are looking, because over the years what we've done, we've simply just added admin staff, and that is obviously not working for us. And so we're looking at two things. The whole issue of revising the registration criteria, which will also inform the revision of registration processes, because we said perhaps even our processes are not adequate or in line with what we are trying to do, because basically what we're trying to do as we move forward is to improve levels of efficiency, and not only effectiveness, but largely efficiency and our responsiveness in terms of the work that we do. So we're looking, there is a subcommittee of the board that is looking specifically on registration matters and regulatory compliance. And what the focus is there is to actually overhaul the whole system of registration. And that is focusing mainly on two things, the registration criteria and the registration processes. Because we are saying it can't be acceptable that it must take 21 days when anyone of us wants a loan at the bank, you know within 30 minutes whether you have a loan or not. And possibly we're looking at even more bigger risks in terms of dealing with the loans, and yet we can provide a more speedy service as the CIDB when it comes to upgrades. So we are looking at those matters. The issue around achievement of only 9 targets as opposed to 13 for our procurement and delivery management unit, yes, it is a concern. But having said that, we also need to understand the fact that that particular department works very closely with the National Treasurer. And I'm sure all of us are aware that Treasury has introduced new procurement reforms as from the 1st of April. And some of these procurement reforms have actually impacted on some of the work that was in planning so far as CIDB is concerned. And that is why it has become very important that we work closely with Treasury in terms of us collaborating with them insofar as procurement, the procurement regime is concerned, so that we speak one language and we don't confuse clients, because at implementation stage, there was that confusion. So what is CIDB doing in terms of what Treasury has now introduced? Who do we listen to? We had a standard for uniformity. Now Treasury has introduced a new standard for infrastructure development and procurement management, which has incorporated the CIDB standard for uniformity. So what do we do? But we also take cognizance of the fact that the implementation of the SIPDM, the new standard for National Treasury, has not necessarily rolled out insofar as municipalities are concerned. Rolled out in the sense that it was implemented this year in March, but it's only going to be implemented in provinces because the financial years are different. So with this year's audits, it will only be audited at provincial and national departments, and the municipalities will only start being audited a year later. So we still need to strike that balance in terms of ensuring that we capacitate insofar as what CIDB has introduced, and making sure that there's alignment and the two processes talk to each other in terms of not confusing the clients. On the issue around the 13 billion that went back to Treasury and how we turn back the situation, obviously this is not entirely in the control of the CIDB, in the sense that CIDB does not necessarily spend the 800 billion that gets allocated. But having said that, in terms of the new strategy that the board has embarked on quite extensively going forward in 2016-17 and beyond, is we've said we need to strengthen our monitoring and evaluation role as the CIDB by making sure that we monitor this industry and we are able to advise insofar as what we monitor. And we said we want to also focus on issues of research and how we analyze the stats that we get. So we need to be in a position where we are able to, and I think honorable member mentioned the whole issue of making sure that there's links with what happens in municipalities and all of that. That's the drive that we're trying to actually get to say we need to be aware when the Minister of Finance makes his budget statement, CIDB must be one of the organizations that must have informed some of the things that the minister said. When the minister says there's 800 billion allocation insofar as infrastructure is concerned, ours is not only to just focus on whether we have contractors to do the jobs, but we also need to know if the municipalities and the different clients are even able to deliver. Hence we're even looking at things like the client recognition scheme, where we want to access the capability of clients to deliver, so that where there is inability to deliver, we look for alternative means for those client departments or municipalities to deliver, so that we don't have this problem. Because on the one hand, we have monies going back to treasury, but on the other hand, we have contractors complaining that they don't have access to work. So we need to start striking that balance and making sure that we cover the areas where there are shortcomings insofar as delivery is concerned. And lastly, on Honourable Colour Barnett's questions, is the issue of the dismissals that we've reported on, if any of them were criminal. These cases were largely issues of misconduct, failure to escalating problems, therefore resulting to irregular expenditure, unauthorized absence, failure to comply with work procedures, dishonesty, conflict of interest, insolence, and dereliction of duties, as well as issues like poor work performance, absenteeism. Those were largely the misconduct cases that we dealt with in terms of what we've reflected in the annual report. And then moving over to Honourable Adam's questions, the first one dealt with slide 9 around the number of foreign firms that we have in our register. We have a total of 34 foreign firms out of the 120,000 plus. And the grades where these foreign firms are actually sitting is we have about 12 firms in grade 9. And we have 3 firms in grade 8. And we have 19 between grades 2 to 7. Those are the 34 in terms of the foreign firms. And then
May I just ask for a repeat of that one figure of the total number, please? Thank you.
Yes. The total is 34. We have about more than 120,000 in our register, 80 to 90% of whom are grade ones. On the issue of register of professional service providers, as reflected in so far as the stats that we got from CISA, looking at the civil engineering of South Africa stats, it is clear that there is more of a serious problem insofar as transformation is concerned. And yes, if we get to a point where CIDB does develop a register for professional service providers, we are going to have to look at issues around how we're going to address transformation insofar as that aspect is concerned. And on the issue around whether we've benchmarked, we have looked at international best practices in terms of what we show in slide 11, I would say yes, in the sense that the bulk of what we do or introduce as the CIDB is largely drawn from from Australian practices as well as Singapore practices insofar as a similar kind of organization is concerned. They have CIDBs of some sort in those countries, and they have these they already have a register of professional service providers, and what we are introducing, or rather proposing, is largely drawn from what is already existing in those countries. And what is shown in slide 13, and the question was, where are the other provinces, because they are not shown. If you look at that particular slide, we're reflecting departments and all provinces that are sitting above 90% or sitting below 60%. The provinces that have not been mentioned are sitting between those percentages. So they are sitting between above 60% and below 90%. And then in terms of the toolkit and the success rate, we are currently undertaking a study that's going to look at the uptake of the toolkit. However, currently the adoption in terms of departments that are using the toolkit, we're looking at health, education, transport, and public works in all provinces. They are using the toolkit. And the other question was around our training that we provide. No, it is not accredited. But it is one of the things that we're looking at in terms of us maybe coming up with better interventions insofar as issues of training and capacitation is concerned. But currently what we provide as the CIDB is merely capacitating departments, and it is not necessarily accredited. Slide 19, the question was around the graph and why it is decreasing in terms of the skilled labor. I think what I could say there is possibly two reasons. It's the whole issue of access to work opportunities, and as well as issues that contractors have insofar as subcontracting is concerned. And these have been identified also in terms of the study that we did in 2013 on the subcontracting matters in the industry. So if one then looks at the fact that we having a graph that's showing a decrease in terms of the skilled labor, it is largely caused by the fact that there is a shortcoming in terms of availability of work. And this is what one of the things, if you look at our developmental plan in terms of what we are proposing, if we go the best practice fee, the 0.2% that will be charged to clients, if you look at the developmental plan, it's largely focusing on issues of development and skilling of contractors, and that's one of the reasons why we want to focus that fund insofar as developmental matters are concerned. The next question was around slide 34, the fact that we have 86 semi-skilled people in our structure. Maybe let me start by saying the fact that the total of 196 in our structure, half of that is youth. Half of that. So 50% of our total structure is youth, and yes, 86 is sitting at semi-skilled, and this is largely because of the nature of our work. A lot of these youth is actually administrators, data capturers, and so forth, sitting either in provinces, as I mentioned earlier, that largely in provinces what gets done is the registration of grade one and the collection of documentation that goes to head office insofar as grade 2 to 9 is concerned. So if one looks at the bulk of the work that we do operationally as the CIDB, it deals with registration of contractors. So we have mainly admin people in our structure. That's why you will look at a bigger concentration of lower levels insofar as our structure is concerned. And therefore, the fact that they are data capturers, admin, and the skill that is required there is basically semi. And then the whole issue around what we are showing in the annual report about the fact that there's inadequate transformation, yes, that's what we are saying. And we are saying going forward, if I may just give highlight of what we focused on in terms of our strategic planning sessions as we move forward. The board has identified five key themes in terms of our new strategy, and those themes are basically
regulation, development, transformation, partnerships, as well as a high-performance organization. So on transformation issues, this is one of the areas that where we are going to focus mainly on the issues of monitoring and evaluation, analysis of what's happening in the construction sector, reporting and giving and being an advisory board insofar as advising client departments, government insofar as what's happening in the sector, and then coming up with proposals in terms of the policy directions that government should be taking in addressing issues of transformation, because we need to address these issues. And as also identified in our National Stakeholder Forum, in terms of the transformation framework, in terms of the five key factors that we identified have to be addressed so that we address issues of transformation. The outsourcing of the internal audit unit, yes, currently it is outsourced, and that contract I think expires next year because it's in its second year now. We are embarking on the organizational redesign, which we are hopeful that its proposals or its recommendations are going to be implemented in the new year that's coming, in the new financial year. So we want to align the new strategy with the new organizational structure that responds to the focus areas insofar as the new strategy is concerned, and that basically enhances and strengthens our mandate insofar as that is concerned. So currently, we were operating with an outsourced unit in terms of internal audit. The plan going forward is that all the areas that are critical in terms of our delivery as CIDB should be incorporated within the new structure. And it is not only internal audit. If you look at the fact that we deal with a lot of legal and compliance matters, looking at issues of compliance, transgressions insofar as the industry is concerned. We have a unit within CIDB, but when it comes to investigations and all of those things, it is outsourced. But we've said in terms of our strategy, those things need to be incorporated within the structure so that we have adequate professions within the structure and that are able to advise insofar as what the CIDB, and if we want to position ourselves as a knowledge authority and providing an advisory role to government, we need to have requisite professionals within our structure and not having some of our key deliverables being outsourced as it is currently. In terms of the MTBPS and the whole issue of internships, we have also identified the fact that we need to find a way to assist insofar as reducing unemployment in the country by using unemployed graduates to actually have internship programs within the CIDB. We have introduced, but on a very minimal scale, unemployed graduates within the CIDB insofar as admin issues are concerned. I mentioned earlier that some of the problems insofar as the delays that we have with registration, we've basically tried to address those with just introducing more people, but that has not necessarily helped us. And besides, we have also said we need to take stock, in fact, in terms of what we try to introduce as the CIDB around internship. We need to have proper programs that the unemployed graduates come into CIDB and do so that we are able to assist them to actually find better jobs going forward, and for us to also identify those that can be incorporated within the structure. So these are some of the things that we want to focus on or spend more attention on as we move forward in the year, in the new year. And then if I move all over to the issues that were raised by the Honorable Phil Danner, number one, the issues around slide 10 about the qualified professionals. I think firstly I just need to mention the fact that this is obviously still under consultation and it's a proposal.
But having said that, I think we also need to look at this with the eye of saying there is a problem in government insofar as the resources that are able to assist government in delivering a consent. What I mean by that is that most of the projects, infrastructure projects that government does, are actually informed or rather assisted by outsourced professionals or project managers that are assisting government. Now, what we are saying in terms of introducing a register of professional service providers is we want to focus on this aspect as well. And we are saying if it is meant to be a register of professional service providers, we need to have professionals. And this is what we are also now trying to address in reverse insofar as register of contractors is concerned, because what we did and what we are still doing, which is what we want to address, is this whole thing of having a floodgate of people that just register and they want to be contractors, who, and some of whom, majority of whom, if you look at our register, are not real contractors. But it's people who register simply because they hear the minister saying there's 800 billion and they say, there is an opportunity for me as a business person or whatever to go and register a company and register at CIDB because I'm going to find work. Because those are the same problems that we are now faced with, because then they start saying CIDB doesn't deliver because they expect CIDB to then give them work and CIDB can't. Now, we need to make sure then with all the things, the problems that we are having in the delivery of infrastructure in the country, we need to make sure that we have a professional, qualified professionals insofar as these consultants that advise these contractors. And this, if you look at what we are proposing, because this also speaks to a question that was raised by Honorable Memasir, the whole fact of us, what we are proposing, we're only proposing four grades. And the four grades are not actually grades that talk to the nine grades that we have in the register of contractors. We are simply saying for professionals, we're proposing four grades, grade one, two, three, and four. And that deals with, and then we differentiate those in terms of their capacity to deal with specific maximums in terms of the professional fees that they bill, and then the other question around that was the impact given the skewed academics that we have. I think it's one of the issues that working closely with the likes of the construction built environment, the CBE. We're going to have to work together and look at those things to address the whole issue of the skills and what the youth actually look at when they go to university. We want to bring back that interest in the built environment in terms of what then the youth gets to do. Because that's the other area. We obviously can't have everyone registering at the CIDB as a contractor. Some would need to register as professional service providers. And that's why we're recommending that there should be professional engineers. We have a lot of youth that have done engineering and they have no work and they could assist in these issues. And lastly, dealing with the questions that were raised by Honorable Memasir. Firstly, is the whole issue of the register of subcontractors as to how we're going to do it. I will send through the Secretariat Chairperson. We have a report here on the state of subcontracting in the South African construction industry. We did a study in 2013 on the state of subcontracting, and we did identify, or rather the research that we did identify some challenges in the industry insofar as subcontracting is concerned. And of key importance is that predominantly the issues, the three key issues that subcontractors are faced with is one, the issue of delayed payments. One, pay when paid. because the main contractor saying, I can't pay you because I haven't been paid, and the subcontractor not being able to even confirm whether this person has been paid or not. That was identified predominantly as an issue around the state of construction when subcontracting when we did the study. The other thing that was identified as a serious challenge was the issue of bid shopping. And that's basically the main contractor going around looking for subcontractors who are going to be able to do work with very minimal costs. So they charge the client billions or millions, and then they get subcontractors who are going to charge very little so that they then benefit the most out of the subcontracting arrangements. And then the other key thing that was identified in this research was the whole issue of poor quality by subcontractors. And so what we've identified, Honorable Chair, is that CIDB, it becomes very important for us to regulate the area of subcontracting, because what is currently happening is a particular department would appoint Khumalo Construction, for instance, as an example, who is a particular grade based on the amount of construction works that has to be done. But then Khumalo Construction goes and appoints 10 subcontractors who may at times not even be CIDB registered, because what we look at is the one that has been awarded, who is a CIDB registered contractor. But then Tenzo was mentioning that we want to overhaul even the whole system of registration in CIDB and looking at the issues around our processes and our criteria, because what then becomes problematic is that subcontractor A will then bring that particular experience to CIDB to come and register, and at times they would even qualify for a bigger grade because they have brought in evidence that they've done work of a particular nature, and therefore CIDB registers them at that particular grade. So they don't even come at grade one at times, which is also happening with the whole issue around the private sector, that they then bring all those evidence to CIDB to register, and they come at higher grades as opposed to the entry level, because they've done work of a particular nature outside of being CIDB registered. So it's one of the things that we are currently doing. So that's why we've identified that we need to come up with a register of subcontractors so that we are able to even regulate that particular area, because we've also, through these interactions with contractors at provinces, they've also mentioned the fact that they need CIDB to assist because they are being abused as subcontractors. I think I've covered the whole issue of the professional registered professional service providers and why we need them to have some form of profession, some form of capital, so that we know that we're dealing with authentic companies that will advise government and will advise the contractors that we use, and why, and the whole issue of why up to grade 4 and not grade 9. It's just that we've identified 4 grades. But also on the register of contractors, with this whole review that we are doing, we want to even look at that. Do we really need to have 9 grades, or should we be looking at a different system? So those are the things that we need to look at. I think the issue around access to credit was covered. And then the issue of the unemployed youth, I think I've covered. The vacancies. The question was how long has been, what has been the longest vacancy? I would think that it's probably the CEO in terms of the vacancies that we have, and that has been vacant for almost 2 years. So, that's what we have. And the number of vacancies is just over 10% in terms of our total structure. And as I said, the plan is to address the whole issue with the organizational redesign that we are embarking on. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. First, Honorable Fultani, and then Honorable Kola Banet.
Thanks for the opportunity for a second bite, as it were. We appreciate the comprehensive responses that we have put. I'm not doing this exactly the aim, so stand in the NA. just a follow-up one. As we explained, the irregularities, the types of offences as asked for by Honourable Kola Banet. Just focusing on irregular expenditure as such. My understanding of irregular expenditure is that someone has gone against stated regulation. Why is it not classified as a criminal act in terms of our justice system when you break or ignore a specific piece of legislation is supposed to be taken to a court of law? And whether Honorable Kola Banet had this in mind or not, I am of the view that such cases are not for the institutions like yourselves to deal with. Once there's prima facie evidence, you know, where you should be having an appetite to refer them to the appropriate authority, because we don't expect you to be having investigators qualified as such. It should be an ancillary job to do some kind of investigation. And once you establish that there's prima facie evidence, then you hand it over to people who deal with the typical criminal suspect. It's quite a complex case, is that. You can recall just the Duke case of 2014, where because he had not declared that he had taken drugs, therefore his mental state was such that it could be assumed that he had legally the mental capacity to concoct a murder. But the moment he admitted that he had taken drugs, the whole scenario changed. Now, in terms of law, once you have taken a certain amount of drugs, you are supposed not to have mental capacity to plan a murder. And therefore it was converted to a homicide. So you're entering into very, very dangerous space. You could be having a number of criminals hopping about within your institution just because you made that error of judgment. Whether the Auditor General classifies this as they're an institution. It's people like yourselves who are working, you know, in that space. So I would suggest, Chair, that we specifically ask them to investigate the reasons, to come up with reasons why people who are accused of regular expenditure should not simply be charged criminal. You don't waste time trying to be criminal investigators. The NPA and the Hawks are there to do that. And that was the first one. The... I don't know who's heading, who would be appropriate to head those investigations. But I'm not going to go into that. That's it. So it looks like, you know, and indeed the CEO has implied this. It looks like we've reached a stage now, as this committee, where it has become inevitable for us to be able to do our job more efficiently than we're doing at the moment, to begin to link, you know, with other committees, you know, in the presence of when we have got institutions like we've got today, to link with other committees like the Department of Labor and so on. So that, because they are direct links, we're talking labor issues here, you know, extensively, unavoidably, and as a matter of need. You know, where maybe we should, when we plan who is going to come and report to the committee on a given day, then we make a joint appointment with the Department of Labor to say, this institution typically has got, you know, critical labor issues. Quite a lot of the work that they're doing is actually centered, you know, around the, you know, where labor practices. And you know, and so on. Development of small businesses also should be an unavoidable partner, you know. So we need not just continue as this committee to do things like they were doing in 1910. We should be more creative for better efficiency. I humbly submit, Chair. I know we are not ready to respond to that at this point in time. I'm not putting you on the spot, but just to say, you know, where the management of the committee should look into that critically. Thanks for the opportunity, Chair.
Honourable Sir Tani, thank you.
Chair.
We are not in 1910. Honourable Colabani.
Thank you, Chair. I think what Honourable Kitani raised is true. In various entities, one does see people fired, and they simply put on their CV, they worked for you for this from this time to this time, and next thing they're hired in a similar area, and when what they've actually done is would be, in my terms, a criminal act, but you simply dismiss them. And they just, if you now go to somewhere else and you go somewhere else, there's no institutional memory, they phone and some secretary says, yeah, that person worked here, and they're back in the game. So it is an issue, and I can't stand this recycling of this trash, where they're fired for terrible actions. I mean, insubordination, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but the next employer never knows. So it is an issue, and especially, I mean, you have in public works as a whole an issue with irregular expenditure, and I would look at it very, very closely. The nine grades, when you said, do we even need nine grades, that immediately made me wonder, where did the nine grades come from? Is this based on international construction best practice? If you're looking at, as you say, Singapore, I mean, they've just gone whoosh, amazing building there, but if it's based on international best practice and divide that along, that there's a global recognition factor with what we do and other nations do, that I can understand, but I'm very interested to know where on earth it came from. And if cutting it down to seven or six would be more effective and efficient or not, I mean, they must be there for a reason, because one has to work one's way up the ladder to get to be able to build a soccer stadium or a hospital. You can't just take someone down here and say build it because it's going to land on your head. So I'm very interested in the background there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. On page 93, under the head irregular expenditure, there are four instances of legacy contracts referred to, where people were involved in irregular procedures that cost the entity money, and they are no longer in the employ of the organization. What are we doing to obviate this situation in future? You've had to write off people not following supply chain management. They just left the organization. Others, no contract. Contract expired. So we can't have a situation where people willfully don't follow supply chain procedures and they engage in a huge contract, and the next time they say that, no, we are out of this organization. There should be ways of following, irrespective of whether the individual has left the organization or not. So if you could kindly just speak to those four instances. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the issue of dismissals, and which we'll obviously talk to the issue of legacy contracts as well, Then what I just need to mention, the 2 million that we've reported insofar as the irregular expenditure is concerned, which is the only issue highlighted by the Auditor General in our annual report that is short of being a clean report, is the fact that these offences were offences insofar as transgressions in terms of the supply chain management framework. And the irregular expenditure, obviously we did internal investigations in terms of what happened, and part of the internal investigations that we conducted, we also confirmed that services had been rendered. So it was issues where you would find that there wouldn't be a tax clearance, for instance, that could be found in the documentation, or issues, instances where we have continued to pay a particular service provider because when we awarded a tender, they had a valid tax clearance certificate, but in year two, they had not necessarily given us a new tax clearance certificate, but we had continued to pay, which then renders that those payments irregular in the sense that they had not provided new tax clearance certificates. And those particular issues, we have dealt with them in terms of addressing the issues with the employees concerned, where there were other given written warnings and the like. But, and we've also cancelled the contracts where the service providers could not give us new tax clearance certificates. In certain instances, you would find that a contractor would then, in the middle of the contract, when you require a new tax clearance certificate, they give you a tax clearance certificate that shows that they are now in joint venture with a different company. And we would obviously stop that contract, and it then becomes irregular in the sense that we had made payments, obviously not having known the fact that this particular service provider can no longer give us a tax clearance, and instead they're now giving us a tax clearance under a different name, which is obviously unacceptable because that new name would not have tendered with the CIDB and would then cancel that contract. So those transactions then became irregular, and then we dealt with the officials concerned, where they were given written warnings in terms of them not having checked in certain instances or even been vigilant enough to even see that these particular contractor service providers did not have adequate documentation. So we considered the fact that services had been rendered, and in certain instances in certain instances it would be cases of goods had been delivered and CIDB had obviously received benefits out of those particular instances. So there were none of these transactions where we established that they had not been done or anything like that. So we looked at those issues. On the issue of the direct links with other committees, we welcome the comment, and also to just say that, as I mentioned, in terms of the strategic themes that the board has identified going forward, the departments that you made examples of are in the list of strategic partners that we need to focus on, particularly departments like labor, because of the instances that we've had in the previous year and before, where we've had health and safety issues in sites, construction sites, where as the CIDB, yes, it would be a CIDB graded contractor or even private sector, whatever the case is, but yes, there is expectation from CIDB to deal with such cases. However, health and safety issues are regulated by the Department of Labor. Hence, we then need to have those particular collaborations and partnerships so that we have a common approach in terms of how we deal with these matters. The issue of the 9 grades, Chairperson, I wouldn't want to speculate in terms of where whether these had been benchmarked internationally, but I would guess that because our registers, how we started with our registers, CIDB had gone on study tours to Singapore, to Australia and Malaysia. I would assume that in those years we benchmarked against some of those with some of those countries.
So, you went to all these places without a single MP next to you.
Honorable Vitali, I can see you are green with envy. I can only leave you green with envy. Proceed, madam.
So I can only assume, and on the basis that what we are recommending now with the Register of Professional Service Providers has largely been taken from what Singapore and Australia is already implementing, I can only assume that even back then when we started introducing the ROC, which is the Register of Contractors, we had seen this from those countries. Nonetheless, through you, Chairperson, I could say that because I've mentioned that there is a subcommittee of the board that is focusing on these issues, we will, when we come back after that work is done, and give, in fact, even when that work is still in progress, we will come back and give a progress report in terms of how we are approaching the whole issue. I don't know. Maybe we'll end up with more grades, maybe with less, I don't know. But we're simply saying we are looking at the whole system of registration insofar as our registers are concerned. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Chair, just to add two things really, to say that there's an organisation that we, most of us, very aware of, is SIU. They are very busy there at the CIDB, doing all sorts of investigations. So we are subjecting everybody, doesn't matter who they are, you know, under that kind of scrutiny. It is not without challenges, as the Deputy Minister maybe would know, because it is quite a very expensive exercise, very expensive. So we are on their back to really produce. We can't wait to conclude some of the things that they're busy doing. So we're on top of that. The issue of the study tour, Honorable, and then you'll be happy to know that we are in discussions with the Minister and the Board to pick a country that now that we are revising everything in the law and the CIDB, how we do things, to pick a country that closely resembles who we are in terms of size, in terms of economy, in terms of challenges and all that. And we will be next year sometime, if the Minister allows it, we'll be going to visit and we'll be going to look at it, and the DM says no. So that we really should begin, in my view, run this organization in a manner that international organizations should be run.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Deputy Minister, it seems as if you would like to share something.
Yeah, if I could.
You may.
First of all, I can't delegate up with that. I mean, I can't, unlike you. Unfortunately, the seat is empty.
Yeah.
For good reason, the Minister is busy elsewhere. But I'll delegate the decision of whether you can have this overseas trip or not. I'll delegate that one up. So I have no power in that. I'd like to also express, I think, as members of the committee have done, express our satisfaction and appreciation to our colleagues from the CIDB on behalf of the ministry. You know, it's very rare that you get a grade 9 in their first input, a grade 9 input from Honourable Colabano and the Honourable Fulcani. I think they started to downgrade it to about 8 in their second one. But anyhow. So I think there's a general appreciation, and I'd like to share with that. Just first of all, to really reinforce the point that you're making and believe that it's a correct move, and that is to really have a serious look at the grade one issue. I think it's a huge drag on institutions, and it raises false expectations. So you say something like 80 to 90% of the 120,000 odd registered entities are in grade one. And all it does is requires basically a small sum of money and the act of registration. And it falls into, in my view, and now perhaps I'm getting more ideological than I should, but it falls into this myth that everybody can be an entrepreneur. Yeah. All you have to do is really, you hear it, Ashraf Garda, okay, hates this life on my part, but I'm sure that's the message that gets, the sermon that gets preached on a regular basis, that, if you really want it bad enough, you can do it, and so on and so on and so forth. And that really sets up millions of unemployed people, underemployed people, and so on for failure, really. And that's why I really like the direction you're going, which is let's focus on the professional skills and capacities and encourage that development rather than raise expectations amongst, hundreds of thousands of people. Not the 100,000, who are in grade nine. So really to appreciate it. I want to make another, perhaps it's a bit of an ideological point, but what are we in regards as a department and as a ministry in regards to CIDD? Well, you're the profession. We're not that, but we are the policy department. And it's more in the area of policy that I want to talk, and a little bit inspired by the Honourable Sultani's question. So if we go to slide 22, basically, that's that slide which suggests that there is decreasing client satisfaction. Okay. Now, obviously, it's a fairly short time span. We're talking about 2012 to 2015, basically. And that applies even more to the other short time span. When we look at skill shortages and so on, really, we're talking from quarter to quarter. And that, I think one can't really get a serious gauge of the issue from a quarter to quarter, but interesting to observe them. And it might just have to do that with projects have terminated somewhere and in some place and they've moved somewhere else and we still workers on, and so on. That's one of the problems with construction is that it's locality based and people and it moves. But if you look at that, then the reasons given don't makes sense unless you then think through the other additional points that you made in your oral responses. So you say the decreasing client satisfaction is likely to be due to the decrease in availability of work, increased competition, and decrease in profits. But I thought if there's, for instance, increased competition, one would expect, according to classical theory, which I don't have to follow, isn't it? But increased competition would produce better quality and therefore greater client satisfaction. So, okay. So I suspect that the concern, we're talking about client satisfaction, but actually what we're talking about at the bottom is the construction sector's dissatisfaction, that there's increasing competition, there's declining profitability and stuff. And I'm making this point rather long-windedly because it links to what I thought was an interesting shift going on in the Honourable Sultani's input. Because at one point he was thinking from the perspective of emerging contractors, and at another point he was thinking from the perspective of someone who's building a house by a client and who's dissatisfied. Okay. So when we think from the perspective of emerging contractors, then we begin to ask the question, aren't you setting too high a standard? Isn't it going to make it difficult for people to qualify in grades 2 and 3 and move up the chain if you're saying you've got to have a professional, one professional, one and two professionals and so on, isn't it making it difficult? But from a public interest, or from a client interest, it is surely an interest to ensure that there's greater professionalization in the practice. And so we mustn't just sit, so your key clients are obviously the contractors and subcontractors and so forth. But their interests are not necessarily identical with the public interest. And that's our duty as politicians, MPs, and it's the pressure we need to put on you, is to say, yes, of course you've got to look at issues and concerns confronting not least emerging contractors, but not just them. But how do you do so in ways that don't undermine the public interest? So if we go back then to your brief summary of your legislative mandate, which is on slide 4, obviously a summary. So it basically says, nicely, strategic leadership is the mandate of the CID to stimulate sustainable growth, reform and improvement of the whole of the construction sector. Now, obviously, you're not alone in this space. You're not the silver bullet that can do everything. And so when the Honourable Sultani says, you know, we can't measure you up against the whole construction. It might have gone backwards, the construction sector, but it might not. If you hadn't been in place, it might have gone backwards further. So there are all kinds of contrafactuals in this huge space. But we do need to get a sense of how, as a department overseeing CIDB, even if there are all kinds of other problems, at least the money we're investing, or that you're investing, is having a public interest impact, basically. In this particular sector. Okay. Now, the trouble is that because you're under pressure from the majority of your registered members, it's going to be about transformation in the narrow sense of the word. It's about, which is an important public interest job, to ensure that there's greater black ownership, greater black representativity, and so on. That's very important. But, you know, black monopoly capital in the construction sector might be as collusive as white monopoly capital, frankly. Might be no better or no worse. Now, don't misunderstand, I'm white, but I'm red, okay? trying to be red here. The disempowerment of the majority of South Africans is a huge, horrible legacy. A horrible fact. I think you said it's an awful fact, a terrible fact that 3% of food in South Africa, yeah. I mean 3%, the majority of food produced in South Africa comes from 3% of commercial farmers. Okay. But for me, the even worse fact is that large numbers of South Africans go to death hungry. And if it became 2% rather than 3%, or you know, if there were more participants, it may or may not impact on the hunger issue. May or may not. So that's all long-winded. What I'm trying to say is that the strategic leadership to stimulate sustainable growth and reform and improvement of the construction sector is obviously about one, amongst other things, black economic power. But it's not the only thing. But when it comes to measurables and so on, we tend to default into that. Okay, I understand it. Yeah, maybe that, you know, and so on. But, you know, it's all kinds of other things. It's about safety, the issue that you mentioned on the virtual front, you know. And again, you're not the only player in that space. The Labour Department is a player and so forth. But we know that safety is poor. And serious injuries, deaths and so on in the sector are poor. So, and presumably that has to do with some of I haven't read the subcontracting point that you made. I mean, the document you've got on subcontracting. I found it really interesting, and I really look forward to reading your documents. There's a lot of malpractice that is happening. Subcontractors subcontracting and getting away with all kinds of things and so on. So there's the safety issue. There's the collusion issue. There's the big, big issue. I mean, what is the big crisis? Because I'd be interested in which country you're going to go and visit when you get the minister. My upward delegation works in, or doesn't work out, you get permission. What country has 37% unemployment in the world? Spain, although it's improving a little bit again, Greece, it looks like it might be going there. You see, because that's the public interest crisis that we've got, unemployment. Okay. That's the big one. I think we all agree. Now, the way in which the construction sector, whether it's grade 9 or grade 2, is it using labor-intensive approach? How do we regulate, how do we build that in? And again, you're not the only players in that space, but how do we measure that? So I could go on and on, but so, now, what I'm trying to underline, Chairperson, is I'm appreciating the questions because I thought they were very useful and helped us also from the ministry side think about it. What I'm saying is, this is not blame. No? This is saying that I think that the ministry and the minister, and I have been saying this, is that we are not sufficiently engaging actively with our entities in general. I think you've seen quite a lot of us, for better and for worse, in the recent period, but about narrow issues around the collusion stuff and so on, okay, which has been important interaction. But I think what it says is that we as the policy department in the space of a critical regulator, we need, so this is a critique of us, we need to improve our policy and get learning from you, and so you're the ones that know about this thing, but we need to be representing, and the committee also, so we need your help as well, to really raise the public interest issue when we deal with our regulators. I think that's really critical. So, yeah, so that's all by way of appreciation. Thank you, for very, very confident and useful and encouraging input. But just to say that obviously we must all up our game, those of us on the side of the department and the ministry.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. CIDD, thank you very much for the presentation. As we have heard from members of the Portfolio Committee, acknowledgement for progress made, but also engagement on areas of possible improvement. An area that we can and should take heed of are the issues foregrounded by the AG's office. So this is not the last time that we'll engage with you, but as we go forward, we'll interact with you. If there are questions that members would like to pose, we do so. If there's a necessity to ask you to come back, we'll do so. Good folks, I think this is how far we can traverse down this road today. Thank you very much to everyone.
Any.